This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, attorney Martin Garbus joins us to report on how the criminal contempt trial of Stephen Donziger turned out.
The great attorney Marty Garbus is trying to protect Stephen Donziger from Chevron and trying to protect the rest of us for what it can do to the environment.
Today we're joined by Doug Henwood to talk about a recent article he wrote on the ruling class.
Who rules America? The most important question. Listen in, because Doug Henwood knows a lot about the answer.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Well, hello. This is Jim Lafferty, host of the Lawyers Guild show on Pacifica's sister station in Los Angeles, KPFK, with a commentary on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The grave injustice done to the Palestinian people in 1948, when over 700,000 Palestinians, 85% of the Palestinian population, were forced from their homes and land by the new state of Israel, has only grown massively worse since then. And although the whole damn world knows it, the world has, to its everlasting shame, done precious little to rectify it. Listeners, I ask you, what more does it need to know than it already knows, before it knows enough and cares enough to take action enough to end this injustice of historic proportions? And closer to home, what more do we, the American people, need to know before we take far, far greater action to stop it than we have so far? Have we not for decades now witnessed Israel's collective punishment imposed daily on the Palestinian people? Not heard the news of Israel's indiscriminate bombings that have killed and maimed, well, thousands of Palestinians over the years? Not known of Israel's constant, arbitrary jailings of Palestinian men, women, and children? Yes, has the imprisonment of stone-throwing children somehow escaped our attention? Do we not already know of the steady growth of illegal Jewish settlements on confiscated Palestinian land? Were we watching, I don't know, some basketball game when the Israeli police stormed into the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem and with weapons firing forced Palestinians out of that holy site on one of their holiest days of the year? And how have we managed to miss the fact that the long-in-place blockade of Gaza and the massive bombings of Gaza have left 2 million Palestinians there with no freedom of movement, with only 4 to 5 hours a day of electricity, where 95% of their water is undrinkable, where 46% of their children suffer acute anemia, and with 50% of their kids expressing no will to live? In short, after all of these many decades, how can it not be clear to anyone with eyes to see, a brain to think, and a reasonable understanding of what is morally right and what is morally wrong, that what Israel has done over the decades and continues to do to the Palestinian people is simply nothing less than ethnic cleansing and genocide? And yet, even as Israel becomes more and more condemned by as a pariah state by much of the world, successive American governments, caring only for America's imperial hegemony, keep defending and arming Israel, no matter how horrific the cost in Palestinian lives. While all too many of we, the American people, just shake our heads, turn away, and say, well, it is awful, but what can we do? It is to my utter amazement that the Palestinian people have not given up, have not stopped resisting, and have not stopped calling on you and me and the rest of the supposedly civilized world to finally, at long last, after 73 years of unimaginable suffering, come to their defense, to finally do something to rectify the grave injustice Palestinians have long suffered, in short, to stop the Israeli genocide of the Palestinian people. Today, the situation is grim. The military and political forces arrayed against the Palestinian people are formidable. Some days it seems the Palestinians' rights will never be recognized, and their plight never ended. But I do not believe that. Why? Because things can and do change. because history reminds us that corrupt and degenerate nations can and have been brought to their knees, because history teaches us that we, the people, have won great victories against great odds in the past. Today, even as Israel's genocidal war crimes against the Palestinian people escalate, more and more enlightened nations and peoples of the world are condemning Israel's actions in Palestine. Millions of people around the world and here in America are all taking to the streets, declaring that this grave injustice must end, and must end now. The battle for a free Palestine will yet be a long and hard struggle. But with history itself on our side, this is a battle we can and must win. But to win it, we must organize more and more massive pro-Palestinian protests, demanding that our government stop sending those billions in military aid to Israel, demanding America joins with those enlightened countries of the world, telling Israel to end its illegal occupation of Palestine, demanding America's anti-boycott, divestment, and sanction laws be overturned, demanding at long last and before there is nothing left of Palestine to fight for, that Israel end its decades-long genocidal occupation of the Palestinian people. Surely, if the children of Palestine can still bravely pick up those stones to throw, we, the American people, should and can do a hell of a lot more than we have so far. Listeners, Dr. King was right. The arch of the moral universe does bend towards justice and freedom. And it bends that way for the Palestinian people too, but it will not deliver that justice to the Palestinian people in time unless we all become part of the growing worldwide movement to make it bend faster. Make it bend fast enough to secure the survival of the Palestinian people and the rise again of a free Palestinian state. Thank you.
After 5 days in court and over 600 days on house arrest, environmental lawyer Steve Donziger chose not to take the stand and testify in his own defense. As listeners will recall, Stephen was on trial for criminal contempt of court charges. In August 2019, he refused to turn over his computer, cell phone, and other electronic devices, and he's been detained pre-trial on a misdemeanor offense. If convicted, Steve faces 6 months in prison. The attorney who won a multi-billion-dollar settlement against Chevron Oil for polluting an area in Ecuador the size of Rhode Island and causing the indigenous people thousands of injuries and deaths by cancer and other illnesses told The Intercept about the decision. Quote, "My lawyer said you'd be crazy to testify, so we decided to cut the case short. No need to continue to legitimize what's essentially a charade." Judge Loretta Preska denied Stephen a trial by jury, and many contend that the jury of his own peers might have acquitted the human rights defender of all six counts. Attorney and Harvard Law School professor Charles Nessen agrees. Quote, "This is a story of the denial of jury trial," said Nessen. "He's been effectively convicted and disbarred and more or less bankrupted without any jury. And now he's about to be convicted, and all of this without a jury." Joining us once again is attorney Martin Garbus, who's represented Nelson Mandela, Daniel Ellsberg, and Cesar Chavez, and has worked in Rwanda, China, and the Soviet Union, among other countries. Martin is part of the Donziger defense team and was in court with him last week. Marty, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Having me.
Marty, it was a long wait, and the defense was in court with Stephen Donziger for 5 days after his 650 days in house arrest. At what point did the defense team decide that it was better if Stephen did not take the witness stand, and why?
We concluded that the real issue in the case, namely Preska's refusal to allow us any information about the prosecution, was so serious that we wanted to argue that We felt that Stephen's testimony would not do him a whit of good and would only lead to bad. We felt that Preska was seizing on everything. Anytime Ron Kuby opened his mouth, she said to him, "This isn't a press conference, it's a courtroom." She did the same to me. Ron Kuby and I together probably have close to 100 years in practice, me being the bulk of it, and not trying to be competitive, but me being the bulk of it. We felt that it was fruitless, and she's not going to let him out of house arrest. So at one point, we want to get away from her as soon as we can. We know it's going to be after conviction, but there's no sense in fooling around. We could have presented, one option was to present 3 weeks of testimony, or attempt to present 3 weeks of testimony as to the structure of the prosecution, the money, the relationships, etc. We decided to close it down, try and litigate that in motions thereafter, and move on. We would like to get him out of house arrest, and we just didn't want to spend 3 weeks more while that just extends his time.
This is interesting for political attorneys like you and Ron Kuby and others who, through history, and you know this, of course, firsthand from many of the people you've represented and the causes that you've represented, that so often in political trials, the defense wants to use every moment to bring the issues at hand to the attention of the public. And so often attorneys will be held in contempt for doing what you and Ron Kuby apparently were doing. I understand the difference in this case, but can you briefly talk about the importance of doing that when one knows that there are slim chances of prevailing?
Well, one of the first thing I said in the opening, and this relates to what you said, is I said Steve was denied a jury when he had the RICO case with Judge Kaplan. He's denied a jury here now in the criminal case. She denied that. So I pointed to the jury box where media was sitting who were covering the case. And I made the point that the jury is no longer just sitting in the Southern District. He's been denied the right to have American citizens to judge him. So it's men, women, and children all over the world now that can see what's going on in the court. And we had all the media in the room to address those issues too. How you address those issues when a judge is resisting it, you know, and it happened Monday, you get to a point of near contempt because the judge doesn't want to hear it. The prosecutor, the Chevron prosecutor, just sat quietly. So basically Monday, when I opened on the 10th, and yesterday when I semi-closed, it wasn't called a closing, each time you're pushing the judge to nearly hold you in contempt. And it's a very close line. It's not the contempt you're seeking. You're trying to get in the argument that you want to make against the judge who does not want to let you make it. So I have been held in contempt before. So I know what the experience is. I think I have a sense of how far you have to push to get your argument in. If you look at Monday and the last two Mondays when I spoke, each time the material that was most relevant to the trial outside the courtroom to the people in the world was done after she denied her application and after she and I got to near contemptuous grounds.
Now, Marty, you have said you've seen many oppressive judges and many rigged court systems. We know this is a peculiar case. We've discussed it with you in the past. But were you surprised that you would see such a level of oppression by judges in the New York area?
I'm not surprised given what's at stake in this case and given who the players are. Kaplan is a small-minded, vindictive judge. It's putting aside whatever decision he rendered in the RICO case, his endless activity after that judgment is astonishing. Here, the U.S. attorney, he went to the U.S. attorney after the RICO judgment, and yes, he says to the U.S. attorney to prosecute the case, prosecute what Danziger did criminally wrong. The U.S. attorney says no. Now, the U.S. attorney knows, of course, he's the U.S. attorney, Jeffrey Berman, he knows what the record is in the RICO case. He knows Kaplan's endless admonishments of him. He knows everything. He had also been a U.S. attorney before he became the chief U.S. attorney for 4 years earlier on. So this is a very sophisticated lawyer who knows the legal system, and a judge comes to him and says, prosecute, and he says no. Now, ostensibly, the reason he says no is I don't have the resources. Jeffrey Berman had 260 U.S. attorneys working for him. He has a budget over $50 million. I wanted to ask Judge Preska, I wanted to say to her, that if you believe in what the U.S. attorney has said, that you tell me he has said, I don't have the funds to do it. And if you think that's the reason, you're believing in the tooth fairy. Except that might push you over the line to contempt. So I tried to say it in every possible way that I could, that it is totally unbelievable to accept at face value that the reason the U.S. prosecutor did not prosecute was because he didn't have the assets to do it. The other thing is that, as you probably know, or some of your viewers will know, Jeffrey Berman was fired. He was fired by Trump and Barr. He was fired by Trump and Barr at the same time that he wanted to look into the prosecution of Giuliani, and he didn't want to look into the prosecution of people that Trump wanted prosecuted. So he's fired. Is he fired also because he refused to prosecute this case? Is this part of that whole mess? We don't know. Will we ever know? I don't know. Are we entitled to an answer to know whether we were caught up in the Trump-Giuliani reason for firing of Berman? I don't know that we'll ever find that out. I know that. As long as any of us are alive, we're going to keep looking for that answer. But Trump and Barr managed to keep all that, well, managed to keep a lot of it quiet. And Mr. Berman was ultimately allowed, if that's the word, to appoint his successor as a condition of leaving. So to the extent that that is Chevron related, to the extent that that's Danziger related, is an issue we tried to start getting at yesterday. She saw it, she closed it down.
Marty, I understand that closing arguments will be submitted in writing in 2 weeks. Is that done often?
Well, when you say writings, findings and conclusions, so that's de rigueur for a criminal case. We're going to try and do something further. We're going to try and continue to get at this information. This information is the key to the case.
So juicy. If Stephen is convicted, will he continue to be under house arrest, or will he have to go to jail?
I don't know the answer to that. She has the ability to put him in jail. One of the problems that Stephen has to face, that we all have to face, if she sentences him and we want to take an appeal, as certainly we do, is she going to keep us in house arrest under the, for an extra period of a year, year and a half until the Supreme Court process, and then he has to deal with 6 months in jail. Mm-hmm. Now, all of that is possible. I mean, she is unrelentless. Now, I was at the argument when the Second Circuit was considering her order to keep him under house arrest. Clearly, many of the judges were bothered by it. But as we also know, this is an area where judges have nearly unlimited discretion. And you could, I forget it was, I think it was Judge Lynch expressing his concern about this. But on the other hand, you have this wide bucket that allows a judge in a situation like this to do nearly everything. I think Preska is appointed there to protect Kaplan, to protect the prosecution. I think that, so there are two things going on in court, Steve's prosecution and the government's defense. And I'm sorry that I wasn't in the case, and I'm saying that disrespect to anyone else, that we didn't start this a long time ago. Really didn't. We started it, but we didn't intensify it until recently.
Marty, there are so many grounds for an appeal. Can you just share a few of the highlights of what you might focus on?
Well, I think there are wonderful grounds for appeal. I also know, I have a sense, that the Second Circuit is not going to disturb any factual finding that Preska makes. I don't think they're going to disturb any factual finding or any implication of Kaplan-ness. So I think that once you decide that that's what's going to happen, you recognize the only place you're going to get relief is in our attack on the whole government process. That we can argue endlessly that Steve complied, that Steve tried to comply, that Steve did all he could to comply, that Kaplan, in effect, I'll use a word that's a technical word, but I'm trying to use it in a more complex, an entrapment against Steve, namely stretching it out and stretching it out and stretching it out until Steve had no options. But Kaplan clearly had a plan. The plan was foreseeable, but Stephen was, because of the structure of the case, unable to deal with it. In other words, Kaplan put him into the position of, you put aside your view, Steve, that if you give us information, we will give it to Chevron, and you're concerned. And the government is basically saying, if you give us the stuff that's in your hard drives and your computers, we won't give it to Chevron. And Steve's disbelief and skepticism and commitment to his client was quite remarkable and puts him in the position that he is now.
Yes, it's almost as if he's been spun into a really heavy, intricate spider's web by all these parties. Will the same legal team continue to represent Stephen?
I assume so. I don't know. I've not been part of those conversations. I'm there. I've been there for 3 years. I'll continue to be there. Ron did the work on the ground and did the bulk of the criminal work. Well, basically did all of the defense work related to the allegations against Steve, and I did all the prosecution, looking at the prosecution. I suspect so. I don't know what the future holds. These are, Ron made an extraordinary, he did this pro bono, and he's been working on the case a long time, and there are an infinite, you know, an enormous number of exhibits. So to ask someone to continue, I don't know, I haven't had the conversation with Ron, but it's a problem that Steve has, getting lawyers into this case and getting lawyers with a certain degree of sophistication, which Ron Kuby has, certainly, a wonderful lawyer.
Yeah,
but it's difficult. Ron Kuby is one of the best lawyers in the country. And he's certainly one of the best lawyers that Steve has had in this case. He's a political lawyer. He understood that he was not just dealing with the facts as the government thought, but he was dealing with something that was far larger than we saw in the courtroom.
Marty, any final thoughts in our remaining minutes about where we are with this case?
I think where we are with this case, I could say that we are at the beginning. And the question is whether or not the New York Times didn't have a word on it, the Washington Post didn't have a word on it, the Wall Street Journal ran several articles with its own bias. The question is, and I think we're at the beginning of trying to get a wider discussion about the issues. There certainly should be criticism of the CEO of Chevron, he's been unscathed. At the same time, CEOs are taking baseball games out of Atlanta. The CEO at Chevron is buckling down, getting seized. So there has to be an awareness made to the Chevron shareholders, at least, of the amount of money that they're spending on this case. In this, the costs in this case easily go to $5 million without going into all the details. There has never been a misdemeanor prosecution in the United States, I suspect, where there was a $5 million cost. There has never been a misdemeanor prosecution for $5 million where it's done by a private law firm which has their own interest in the fossil fuel business. There are so many transgressions in this case, and it has not yet gotten the attention that it deserves. The attention is focused on Steve being in jail for 2 years in house arrest, all valid issues, valid concerns. But the larger issues, your listeners are aware of it. Very few others are.
Which is, of course, what Chevron wants. This case has cost a fortune and will continue to demand great resources. Remind our listeners how they can help.
They can send checks to Steve. He doesn't have an income. He's been disbarred. He's got a wife and a child. I would say he doesn't have an income for the foreseeable future. He's not going to have an income if he's under house arrest. So they disbarred him, taken away his money, and put him in a situation where he can't work. The way you can get funds quickly is through DonzigerDefense.com. There are other things as well, but that is the main source of funds for him right now. And it's thus far, it's totally insufficient.
Right. And we're going to try to change that by getting the word out. I mean, this corporate media is so complicit in scandals like this. Martin, it's just such a pleasure to have you on. Unfortunately, we are out of time. But we will continue to follow this case, and thank you, the entire defense team, and our best wishes to Steve through this ordeal. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
We need to know our enemy, because the task of changing society begins with understanding who holds power. In 1915, the great Irish socialist James Connolly said, "Oh yes, the ruling class are worthy of study. The natural history of the ruling class is a fascinating interest. You begin with interest, you proceed with awe and admiration, you deepen into hatred, and you wind up with contempt for the nature of the beast. You realize that the capitalist class is the meanest class that ever grasped the reins of power." Jacobin Magazine's spring 2021 issue is devoted entirely to an examination of the ruling class. We speak today with Doug Henwood, who has an article in Jacobin entitled, "Take Me to Your Leader, The Rot of the American Ruling Class." Doug Henwood is the editor of Left Business Review and the host of the radio program Behind the News. Doug Henwood, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Always good to be here.
Doug, we need to know our enemy because the task of changing society begins with understanding who holds power. Who holds power now, and has this changed over the last 50 or 100 years?
Well, that's a pretty long topic, but I would say, in general, the ruling class of society consists of... It doesn't map easily onto the very rich. A lot of the very rich are just not that politically engaged or politically thoughtful. And certainly the preferences of the corporate class and Wall Street matter politically, but they also have to articulate with the political class that engages with the state and in political parties, the business wing of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party is a problematic little assemblage, so we could talk about that maybe a little bit later. But much of our politics does reflect the interest of the very rich, but they can't always articulate it directly, so they need a political class to develop an agenda for them. So elite politicians, Trump certainly did not qualify, but Obama certainly did. But also there's a kind of permanent political class of pundits and people who go in and out of government and the private sector. The famous revolving door, where people go from lobbying to corporate positions to high government positions where they hand out favors and contracts and deregulate and do all those kinds of things that make businesses very happy. So, yeah, I think this partnership between the very rich but with a political class that really makes their rule possible. What's changed over the years is that there was once a much more coherent elite in the country, the old WASPs that ran things essentially from the founding of the country through probably the mid-70s, late 70s. They were, in just a sociological sense, a much more coherent formation than what we have now. They went to the same schools, they married out of the same pool, they belonged to the same clubs, they summered in the same vacation spots. Now it's a much more, divided by business sector, by geography, not like the old WASPs based in the Northeast. It's much more geographically divided and much more, I think, politically divided class as well. When we talk about the divisions in the society, elite pundits are constantly complaining about how we just can't get together and have common ground and govern in a responsible, civilized fashion. I think a lot of that is traceable to the fact that the elite is just not the unified force that it once was early, through the late 20th century. It's just much more of a fragmented, RV's new rich crowd that is not really governing very coherently. And we can see that in increasing chaos of American governance, which Trump represented some kind of climax. Now, Biden looks like a return to normalcy in some sense, but we'll see how long that lasts.
What happened to this coherent ruling class, and with what was it replaced?
Well, several things happened. One was that the WASPs got decadent. They became much more interested in the arts than in owning and governing things. Their wealth was divided by inflation and inheritance. Some of the industries that they were based in faced a lot of competition in the 70s onwards. Old line industry, where a lot of them were based, got shaken up. And the comfortable old world of Wall Street that they inhabited, and you could just pop out of Yale and end up as a bond salesman and have a comfortable life for 40 years and retire, that all got blown up. Starting with the deregulation of finance in the 70s, it became a much more competitive, bloodthirsty, market-driven affair, not the relationship-driven thing that it was for so long. So there was that, then the fact that other ethnic groups really began to assert themselves and rise in the society and develop. We saw the rise of new fortunes beginning in the 1980s with Mike Milken and the leveraged buyout craze. It's hard to think of this now, but there was basically no such thing as a billionaire going back to the early 80s when Forbes first started doing its 400 list of the richest families in the country. You could get on that list with a few hundred million dollars, and now it's just the cutoff is in the billions. So there's a growth of this whole new rich class that wanted government out of the way. They really thought the market could do everything, they could do everything, and that all the WASP ethic of stewardship, which lent at least some degree of civilization to their governance style. That all got blown up, too, in the mantra that greed is good. So, it's, you know, the combination of the decline of the old order and the creation of all these new fortunes, much of which got a political expression on the right, that's important. Some of these new fortunes really had no tolerance for the old style kind of bipartisan comity that dominated much of U.S. politics in the mid and late 20th century. They really were, you know, bomb throwers and wanted a revolution. They got one with Reagan, and that new wealth continued to be very, very dominant, especially in the right end of the political spectrum.
We're speaking with Doug Henwood. Doug, in the past, the ruling class members preferred to hide their existence. It was a break from this when the Rockefeller oil heir, Nelson Rockefeller, was elected to be the governor of New York State. He aspired to the presidency. And then recently we've had billionaire Bloomberg as the mayor of New York City, and then Trump as the president. Elon Musk, the second richest person in America, recently hosted Saturday Night Live. How do you appreciate this change?
It is a remarkable change. Elites, the old WASP elite, did serve in public office. The Federal Reserve, for example, was largely, the creation of the Federal Reserve was largely spearheaded by Nelson Aldrich, who gave Nelson Rockefeller his first two names in the early part of the 20th century. But much more subtly, much more under the radar. These people thought ostentation and display was very embarrassing. You know, that old joke about the only time your name should appear in the newspaper is for a wedding announcement and your obituary. That was certainly a dominant thinking among a lot of the old establishment, that they do everything quietly behind closed doors. It's vulgar, and you don't want to attract attention to yourself for political reasons, because that could, you know, just inspire resentment and rebellious thoughts, but also because they had a notion of good taste involving a good bit of repression, whereas, you know, this new class is really just loves to display its wealth. The old WASPs love to hide behind thick bushes and stuff and keep their houses out of view, and now the whole idea is to show how rich you are. William Grider made an interesting point in his book on the Fed from the 1980s. He said the old architecture style of banks used to be solid. You know, they would look like tanks. They were pretty short and solid, and they're supposed to look sober and, you know, really well-founded. Whereas with as finance exploded starting in the 70s and into the 80s, the new style of the bank was the skyscraper going to the sky. It was really much more about ostentatious and wealth display than creating that sense of solidity and permanence. And that's, you know, that ethic now just pervades that whole class. Elon Musk is a really excellent example of that. You know, the guy is on Twitter driving up the value of Bitcoin one day, driving down the value of Bitcoin the next day, and then, you know, driving up Dogecoin and driving down Dogecoin. It's just it's a very different way to relate to the masses, partly because, you know, the technological changes of the communications world, but it's also a change in the sensibility of the very rich. Now, I would say that Trump certainly embodies a lot of that, but there's a real question how rich he is. Michael Bloomberg always teases Trump by saying he's not really a billionaire. He may have a point about that, but I guess we'll find out when Tish James completes her investigative work.
Doug Henwood, I think one of the turning points, all this has sometimes been exaggerated, but nevertheless, it's significant. What happened in 1971 with the Powell Memorandum? Give us the background to that and how things changed afterwards.
Well, Lewis Powell was a corporate lawyer in Richmond and eventually was appointed to the Supreme Court. But he wrote a memo to a friend of his at the Chamber of Commerce. Now, the Chamber of Commerce is a really old-line organization that kind of looked very stodgy at that point. They had never really made peace with the New Deal, whereas much of the corporate class, they didn't love it, but they'd made peace with it and learned to live with it. But there were some hardcore conservative business interests that never really made that kind of peace, and the Chamber of Commerce was that kind of old-school organization. But Powell's memo... early in the decade, 1971, you know, we'd see a lot more of this subsequently, so he really was a pioneer in this. But he was concerned that capitalism was in very ill repute, and that everywhere from college campuses to pulpits. Capitalism and business interests were losing respect, being denounced. Powell was very, very concerned about this and thought that the capitalists needed to organize, defend their economic system, and get out a different kind of propaganda. You know, a distinction in contrast with what we're hearing coming out of the 1960s, the critique of the money culture. And yeah, people do assign perhaps too much causation to Powell's memo and the process of reaction that set in as the 1970s progressed, but it was an important milestone in that. We'd see, you know, things, the Business Roundtable, the founding of the Business Roundtable a few years later, which was an organization of big CEOs to push for a different kind of policy that was much more business-friendly than that we were seeing in the 60s and early 70s. You know, there are many more developments along those lines as the decade went on, but Powell certainly was a pioneer in that corporate reaction.
Talk about the transition of both the Republican and the Democratic parties over the last several decades. How have they both changed, and who do they represent now?
Well, it's hard to say. The Democratic Party in the last few years has changed from what I'm about to say. And it's really hard to measure just how deep that change is or how long-lasting it is, but it's definitely, there are forces within the Democratic Party now to the left of anything we've seen in a long time. But what happened with that party was, Lily Geismer has a very good book on this, a historian, has a very good book, I think it's called Don't Blame Us, came out a few years ago, about what happened to the Democratic Party starting in the 1970s. The role of the urban working class and the associated political machines was really downplayed, and the unions, and they got nudged aside as the kind of professional class in elite suburbs became a much more important force within the party. And she, her book is a study of five towns north of Boston where that kind of elite suburban, not, you know, boring gray flannel suburban. They thought of themselves as intellectuals, MIT professors, Harvard professors, engineers, not your vulgarian from Great Neck or something like that, but a much more posh kind of notion of what the suburbs are all about. And they were the classic combination, which we've come to be very familiar with in the last 30, 40 years, socially liberal but fiscally conservative. So, for example, town Lexington, Massachusetts, one of the ones that Geismer studied, was all about like combating housing discrimination. But the problem is that very few black people could afford a house in Lexington, Massachusetts. So you can be, you know, as anti-racist as you want, but if people can't buy a house in your town, then it's largely symbolic. So that kind of politics became very much larger than the Democratic Party. Also, starting after, you know, a series of defeats, the Democratic Party elites decided that they needed to throw out the old New Deal, Great Society, civil rights side, and become much more Wall Street friendly and tough on crime and tough on defense. And the Democratic Leadership Council, which Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton were early founders and shapers, really transformed the party. Now, of course, we've seen different things happening now with the rise of Sanders, the Squad, Democratic Socialists of America, operating in part through the Democratic Party, has threatened that DLC structure, but it dominated the Democratic Party for decades. Now, the Republican Party is a very interesting story. Going back in the 50s into the 60s, there was not all that much difference between the two parties. They had a liberal wing and a conservative wing, but there was not the kind of geographic and class stratification or separation between the parties that we see now. And one of the reasons for that was that there was a very conscious effort on the part of a bunch of conservatives to take over the party. They hated Eisenhower. They hated the kind of accommodation with the New Deal that Eisenhower represented. They, starting in the 50s, with great discipline and long-term goals in sight, moved to change the party from within. Some of them were actually ex-Bolsheviks, ex-communists, ex-Trotskyists, And they brought with them that organizational and ideological discipline that came from having been in those sorts of formations, brought that to their attempt to turn the Republican Party into a much more explicitly right-wing formation. And it took them a couple of decades. They got the Goldwater nomination in 64. Goldwater got beaten, but 16 years later, their man Reagan won and really did a lot to transform American politics to this day, and world politics even. So it was a very successful counter-revolution from within. And one of the things that was striking about that, which is something in a sharp contrast with people on the left who are trying to change the Democratic Party, the conservatives trying to change the Republican Party didn't mind playing the spoiler role. They didn't mind nominating a right-winger like Goldwater who would lose, because they thought that the long-term fight was worth that kind of sacrifice. People in the left wing of the Democratic Party are often very reluctant to play that spoiler role. When William Buckley ran for mayor of New York City in 1965, he ran against John Lindsay, a very liberal Republican. And Buckley knew that he could draw votes away from the Republican and make a Democrat mayor, but he didn't care. He wanted to destroy liberal Republicanism, and that was a much more important goal to him. So I would say that the right, as odious as they are, does have a much greater sense of organizational and ideological discipline and an eye to the long term that is lacking on the left side of the spectrum often. I wouldn't say anything about the right having kind of long-term sense right now. The right wing of the Republican Party is largely insane. But going back in the decades, they really had a vision of what they wanted to happen, and were quite successful in making it happen.
How does the capitalist class rule? Please talk about their think tanks, university positions, ownership of the media, and the use of lobbyists in Congress and at the state level. How do they rule?
They dominate the policymaking process. They they pay for politicians, campaign finance. The politicians are largely bought and paid for. The right, especially, has produced this amazing machine for writing legislation at the state and local level. The American Legislative Exchange Council, sponsored by Koch and other right-wing money, has all these ready-made bills. So, for example, now we're seeing this wave of anti-trans legislation in about 25 states across the country. They're all very similar. It's because these organized interests have been pushing this agenda to the point where they actually write the bills. A lot of state legislatures just don't have the staff necessarily or the expertise to write legislation. These outside experts do it for them. But then if you the more respectable side of the political spectrum, you've got institutions like the Brookings Institution or the Center for American Progress, which are kind of center-left liberal, produce safe kinds of policies for Democratic governments to adopt. So they serve this this role of forming political consciousness, shaping discourse, and sort of mapping out the limits of what's acceptable in mainstream politics. Then, of course, there's the media, which just bellow endless propaganda about everything. They've lost an awful lot of respect over the last decade or so, but they still have considerable influence. And, you can see that most significant policies that get adopted at the federal and state level reflect the interest of top couple of percent of the population. The broad populace has little influence on that sort of thing. And it's a matter of personnel. The politicians that hold office or the experts that they rely on all come out of a certain narrow set with who think similarly and really don't have the interests of the broad public at heart. They have the interests of their special groups at heart. But one of the things that's happened in the last several decades is that elites have lost, or economic economic elites have, to some degree, lost interest in shaping legislation. They're all interested in what will affect them as an industry or as a company, but they since the early 1980s, when they won pretty much everything in the Reagan Revolution, they've demobilized a bit, and there's not a broad vision of what they think the society should look like, and partly as a result of that, there's just been this loss of consensus throughout the rest of the society. There's not this unified propaganda that has influenced the way people think on the day-to-day level, the way there was like in the early neoliberal era, when Reagan and Thatcher revolutions transformed the common sense of the masses. People internalized a whole lot of market doctrine, doctrine about self-reliance, distrust of government, distrust of politics. People internalized a lot of that propaganda, and now they're pretty alienated from it. They have seen the world that, that kind of consciousness created and don't like it.
From what you've said, the project of overturning class rule and forming a truly democratic society seems enormous. Where do we go from here?
Know the answer to that. The last line of the piece, which is that in Jacobin, which is that it's much easier to mount a revolution from within the ruling class than against it, I must say, was written by Bhaskar Sankara, the publisher and editor of Jacobin, and I'm very grateful for it because it's true that it is much easier to mount a revolution within the ruling class than against it. The only thing I can think of is just organization, persistent organization and demands, and we've seen some of that in recent years, the growth of socialist tendency within the American politics, certainly small, weak, geographically dispersed, but it's something. We're seeing some changes. The kinds of ambitious, I don't want to call them New Dealish, but steps in that direction that that Biden has taken on domestic policy. His foreign policy remains appalling, but his domestic policy is certainly better than anything I expected. I think that reflects this kind of organization, and also the desperation of the moment, but it does that there's just a different level of political organization, political consciousness in the country, and the more, we just need more of it, much more of it. That kind of organization is going to start low. The Sanders campaign did catalyze a whole lot of political consciousness, political organization, but the real change is going to come from below. We need to organize at the state and local level, transform state legislatures and city councils, which are much more amenable to agitation coming from the left. Move up the political ladder, and I guess that's really about the only way we can get any kind of long-term progress, because despite erosion and the rot of a ruling class, it's still quite powerful and dominates an awful lot of policymaking and our consciousness formation, unfortunately.
How can people follow your work?
Just about everything I do is noted or promoted on my blog, lbo-news.com. That's lbo-news.com. That's the easy way to keep up with everything. Or on Twitter at Doug Henwood is the account name.
Been great to have you on Law and Disorder. Thank you so much. You take it easy.
You too. Thanks.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.